dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Few programs that we have conducted over the past 10 years, I believe, require more intelligence and more application of intelligence than does the topic of today's program. And fortunately, we are blessed to have a man whose intelligence is already hard at work on the problem. And that is, how do we assure the future competitiveness of the United States in a dynamic and increasingly dangerous world in which the qualitative edge that we have historically relied upon for our safety and security, as well as our commercial preeminence, is no longer a certitude? His name is Arthur Herman. He is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and the director of its Quantum Alliance Initiative, about which we will hear more momentarily. Arthur is the author of 9 published books and one that is now in the works. His most recent published book is 1917, Lenin, Wilson, and the Birth of the New World Disorder. The one that is now shortly to be out in print is Vikings, which is about Scandinavian immigration to America. The subject near and dear to his heart because his own family is a product of that immigration. We'll talk about that too in the course of the program. But first, let me say a proper welcome to you, Arthur Herman. It is so good to have you back. It's been far too long, and I consider this a promising sign of the new year that we're getting off on the right foot by having you on, and I hope it will be one in which you will be blessing this program often with your insights and mastery of many of these very important topics. Happy New Year to you, sir. Welcome back.
Happy New Year to you, Frank, and it has been too long, and I do look forward to us having more conversations. I think this year is going to be one of the most crucial for the United States, one of the most crucial since the end of World War II, and you and I have a lot to discuss and a lot of information and intelligence to share on what we need in order to keep American leadership on track.
Well, it is going to be a monumentally important year. And I think the topic that I most wanted to discuss with you about what's been called and often vilified as industrial policy is going to be an important part of the national conversation we have to have if indeed the election that is looming and the decisions that will flow from it are going to protect our security as well as our economic competitiveness. Give us a little bit of a tutorial, if you would, Arthur, having thought about this, written about it extensively, including most recently in a very important piece you wrote in American Affairs in November, entitled America Needs an Industrial Policy.
Yeah, and I think the idea of industrial policy is one that needs some definition and clarification, particularly in an American context, where for the past several decades, really, I would say since the end of World War II, we have really thought about and wanted to see the American economy in light of open free markets, of competition in a larger capitalist-driven economic realm, and that we've understood, and Americans have understood, that that kind of free market competition in which the private sector is able to define and create the priorities which spur economic growth, that satisfy the needs and demands of markets, and to supply those markets with the goods and commodities they need, is really the optimal approach to sustaining economic growth and to prosperity. And I think in general, you have to say, Frank, and I think you'll concede that in theory, at least, and in generally in practice, that's true. I think the degree to which we have, and the Reagan years, I think, were a great demonstration of this, the degree to which the government is able to take its foot off of the gas for how economies grow and how markets serve customers and serve the companies who work in those markets really is far superior to the command economies, to socialist solutions to those kinds of questions. It's one of the reasons why today, you know, the push on the part of so many Democratic candidates for socialism, for socialist solutions to our problems, don't really resonate with the American public, because they've come to understand the degree to which free markets really are the best answer. But here's the challenge, Frank. Is that in the larger world, in the world of that globalization has created, we have had the rise of the United States' principal competitor in the economic sphere and principal rival, namely China. And China operates on a far different range of principles and approaches to economic growth and to economic power. And I want to stress that term, economic power, because China understands the degree to which economic growth is a factor of projecting geopolitical, military, and ultimately cultural domination. That's the lens through which they see it. That's the lens through which they've projected their own economic growth over the past two decades or more. And for the United States to assume that the role of government in terms of that competition needs to remain minimal, that private sector will, our private sector and largest companies will figure out ways in which to keep U.S. leadership in critical sectors of our economy, particularly in the area of information and communication technology. And keep our leadership in the digital and then post-digital age. That assumption, I think, has now taken us on some wrong paths going forward. And if you're going to play by rules, it's important that all the players respect those rules. And China does not. And so we have to rethink about how we're going to compete with China in the geopolitical realm and what its impact will be on how we think about economic policy at the same time.
Yeah. We're going to have to pause in just a moment, but I just wanted to say it's bad enough that you can't rely on companies in this kind of environment to make the kinds of resource allocation decisions that will serve the national security interests of the United States, among others. But to the extent that those companies are willing to work with our adversary, Communist China, makes things vastly more problematic, needless to say. Arthur Herman is our guest for this full hour, I'm thrilled to say, because there is so much to talk about with respect to, so what's the alternative to free market capitalism that doesn't strangle innovation in the crib, but actually ensures that it is being fostered and that we are able to contend with an adversary that is playing by a very different set of rules. That and much more with Arthur Herman, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting with Arthur Herman of the Hudson Institute, a man who has written extensively on a whole host of subjects, but one that is a particular passion of his, as it is of mine, is the question of how does America compete against a system like Communist China's that is clearly engaged in industrial policy and the use of subsidies and, well, predatory trade practices and technology theft and all manner of other things in order to advantage itself economically for, among other things, geostrategic and military purposes. So, Arthur, having set the stage for us about what isn't likely to work if they're playing it by a different set of rules, map out for us what the United States should be doing to assure its future competitiveness and, well, survival.
Well, I can think of a number of steps that would be involved. And when we think about what's the alternative, as you mentioned, to free market capitalism, I wouldn't say it's so much an alternative to free market capitalism, but it's a boost to the future of free market capitalism by preserving the United States as the leader in certain key sectors of the economy. I already mentioned one of them, that's information and communication technology. So that leadership, if we're talking about areas such as artificial intelligence, robotics, supercomputers, and the microprocessors and semiconductors that underpin and undergird that information technology, that these are areas in which leaving it to the private sector, we've learned, is not working to our advantage. Either in terms of the growth of those industries in an economic sense, but also protecting American interest in a national security sense. And I think that's really the big question, Frank, that we need to ask ourselves is look over the range of economic activities, the complexity of economic activity that takes place in America, and really weigh it in a different set of scales than just simply are companies involved in that making a lot of money or are they losing money? Does it satisfy the needs of, you know, consumers or not? And think about it, is the growth and sustainment of this technology or of this economic activity fundamental to protecting American interests and protecting our national security? And when it comes to an area like, for example, which I write about in the article, our defense industrial base, namely the industries and the technologies that really support our men and women in uniform, whether it's at sea or in the air or on land, that industrial base and keeping those jobs, keeping that technology both sustained and growing, is something that the private sector is simply not going to meet. There isn't a consumer demand for this. And to assume that companies that are driven and executives who are driven by the desire for market share and for profitability and satisfying the needs of shareholders in the quarterly statements, to assume that those same executives are on their own going to make the decisions to protect our national security is a serious error. And that's true whether we're talking about, you know, defense industrial base or if we're talking about the advanced technologies, which will be part of a future defense industrial base.
Right. Let me just drill down on that with you for a moment, Arthur, because this is a passion of mine, of course, that we've allowed an atrophying of our defense industrial base. I remember Les Aspin famously pulling in the leaders of what was once quite a formidable productive capacity as well as research and development enterprise, and essentially saying there's not going to be enough work for all of you. You got to consolidate, shrink, and go out of business in some cases. And they did. And the truth of the matter is today, especially if we compare and contrast with what the Chinese have been doing to put in place this immense industrial capacity for shipbuilding, for example, and missiles and aircraft and so on. It ain't what it used to be for sure, but arguably it ain't what we need either. And I just wonder, as you've studied this closely, whether it's because we've got a bunch of, you know, corporate executives who are just looking at that bottom line and quarterly reports and all the rest, or whether, as I fear, we've, as a nation, to some extent, lost a sense of, well, I call it national security mindedness, that would make such activities a priority. If you think about it, it should be a survival instinct that you need that kind of industrial base to support, as you say, our men and women in uniform. Yes, but you know, our national security and safety as well.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think that complacency on the part of Americans is a result of two things. Number one, I think it's been the fact that we, in a formal sense, won the Cold War. that we did in fact prevail over the most dangerous opponent the United States had ever faced, namely the Soviet Union and its allies and its dependencies. And that gives us, you know, it's hard to learn the best lessons from winning wars. The people who win the best lessons are the ones who lose them.
They're not going to fight the next one the same way.
They're not going to fight the same way, and you're going to be focused on what your vulnerabilities are, as opposed to preening yourself for your success. And I think for the average American, there's still the assumption that if we got ourselves into a real shooting war with a major power, I mean, not ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Afghanistan or Iraq or even Iran, but Russia or China, that if we got ourselves into a shooting war that lasted, you know, that really was demanded the most from our military force structure, that we would be able to supply our men and women with the ammunition that they need, with the supplies that they require, and the equipment that will enable them to prevail. And what we're seeing is that that's more and more in doubt. I'll give you one example, right? And that is that since 2000, the United States defense industrial base, has shed more than 20,500 manufacturing firms. That's not jobs, Frank. That's companies that have simply dropped out. That's 10 years after the end of the Cold War when, as you were talking about Les Aspin in the famous Last Supper, when defense contractors were told, you got to start shutting your doors and start consolidating because there won't be enough business for you. That's companies that no longer produce or are under contract to produce the things that we need for our defense industrial base. That's not an issue that we can ignore, and it's not an issue that's going to be addressed unless the United States government steps up and says we need to make this a serious priority in terms of investment of resource, investment in our workforce, because the skills that are needed to make that equipment, to make those weapon systems are fading fast. You know, the people who built the weapons and the equipment in the 1990s and the Reagan buildup in the 1980s, they're retiring. Many of those skills are disappearing as a result. And look, this the only way in which you're going to be able to, in order to give to avoid having a hollowed out military, is by focusing on the industrial base that sustains and that expands that capability. And that's one of the, I think, priorities for what we call an industrial policy. That's one important hook of an industrial policy.
And I think it's imperative that we understand, and you certainly do, but I think that the layperson understands the implications of what you've just described. Because if you're down 20,000 firms, for heaven's sakes, you are more likely than not relying on one manufacturer or one supplier of critical parts to provide you what you need. I mean, it's an extremely thin, shall we say, reed on which to rely. And it is emboldening our enemies, is it not, Arthur, when they look at us and realize that we are hollowing out, if not hollowed out, in this regard, that if we were to get into the kind of shooting war you're talking about with a peer competitor, and the war is going to endure longer than, I don't know, 30 days, let's say, that the parts are simply not going to be available to maintain our kit and our troops in the field. And that, again, is kind of a red flag in front of the enemy, I would think, because they figure they can outproduce us, they can endure, and they can prevail.
Yeah, and you know what? We already saw it reach the limit, that limit. We already saw a preview of that with the conflict in Libya, which was, to a large extent, an air war with U.S. Expending JDAMs and other kinds of guided munitions. And it didn't take very long for us to reach the limit of the ongoing supply. And that's against Libya. I mean, imagine if ourselves, as you were saying, getting involved in a peer competitor conflict. But it's actually worse than that, Frank, because what has also happened is that a lot of the work that used to be done by a U.S.-based industrial base for our defense industry has shifted abroad. It's moved offshore, but a good deal of it has gone to China, which is, when you think about it from a, it borders on the obscene. I mean, imagine, as I've written about this too, imagine during World War II, you know, if our troops are going to land on Omaha Beach, and they're carrying M1 rifles and wearing combat helmets that were manufactured in Germany. I mean, what exactly, if you wanted to cut your own throat in a major conflict and to undermine your ability to sustain forces in the field, what better way than to have a very likely potential foe be the one who's making your defense equipment?
We're going to pick up on that point in a specific case study here in a moment, with Arthur Herman on the other side of a very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back with the author of America Needs an Industrial Policy right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are honored to have with us Arthur Herman. He is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, the author of 9, shortly 10 very important books and countless periodical essays and op-eds, including one that really caught my eye and that we're discussing here in length today. One in American Affairs in November 2019 entitled America Needs an Industrial Policy. And Arthur, I just want to spend a minute talking about a particular concern of mine that I think exemplifies the kind of problem you talked about a moment ago with our defense industrial base and the loss of the skilled workforce, as well as the capacity to sustain the kinds of equipment needs and military capabilities that the security of the United States demands. And that is in the context of our nuclear deterrent. I was in the Reagan administration when most of what is in our arsenal was either manufactured and put into place or, in some cases, you know, simply dusted off and continued from having been put into place in the years before the Reagan administration. Now, that's over 30 years ago now, for heaven's sakes. And it's terrifying to me that we have allowed that kind of industrial capability and workforce and know-how to atrophy to a point where I really am concerned that our deterrent is not credible, especially in the face of the kind of concerted modernization programs that adversaries like the Russians and the Chinese, to say nothing of the North Koreans and Iranians, are engaged in it as we speak. And I just would invite you to talk a little bit about that as a sort of case study of the larger problem that you're concerned about, as am I.
Yeah, I think nuclear arsenal is a classic example of where I think the American public and even policymakers have made two basic assumptions about our nuclear deterrence. One is that, again, because we prevailed in the Cold War, therefore we have nothing to worry about with regard to our nuclear arsenal.
Ever again.
Ever again. And then the second one is the idea, oh, no one will ever use these weapons anyway. And so that with the end of the Cold War, the issue of nuclear deterrence really faded away and disappeared as a public policy issue that we need to concern ourselves with. And that in fact, to spend time, as you've done, and others, including colleagues at the Hudson Institute, like Rebecca Heinrichs, have done, to worry about how we update our nuclear arsenal is a form of warmongering. And it's a way of trying to return us to the bad old days when the world sat on the knife edge of nuclear holocaust, et cetera, et cetera. So you combine complacency on one side and then a kind of globalist pacifist agenda, which, as you know, and I think is always important to emphasize, has really infiltrated itself into some of our biggest high-tech companies and firms, especially in Silicon Valley. You put those two things together and you have got a plan for inaction that really is can pose really a serious threat to American national security. We're not doing anything, or we're trying to and struggling in the process. The Russians are updating theirs. The Chinese are updating and expanding their nuclear arsenal because they understand just how important those ultimate weapons are for projecting power and making deterrence a credibility, especially in contact with a competitor like the United States.
Yeah, and very clearly, they have doctrinally the use of such weapons if they believe it will advantage them to engage in it, to the point where Vladimir Putin, of course, as you know, Arthur Herman, is routinely, I think several times a year, but it's certainly annually at least, personally presiding over and actually executing himself the command and control of the thermonuclear attack that these exercises routinely stimulate against the United States.
Yeah, sure. I mean, why would he do anything else? I mean, yeah, these are, in their view, these are force multipliers, whereas we've sort of banished them from even thinking about it in terms of both military conflict, but also scenarios in which what are you going to do when your back is to the wall and you need to have a credible arsenal with which to counter a potential or actual threat.
Yeah, but you know, I've given to saying that if this were the Cold War, before some of that complacency set in, if this were just an environment in which we were objectively looking at what the Soviet Union used to call the correlation of forces, I'm talking about nuclear forces, we would be on high alert, I believe, at this moment with the kind of buildup that the Russians have engaged in. It makes what the Soviet Union did in its heyday pale, honestly, by comparison. There's something on the order of 22 different nuclear weapon systems that have been introduced by the Russians in the past few years, all of them, you know, very modern and very dangerous. And you combine it with this doctrine, you combine it with these exercises, you combine it with building means of protecting not just the leadership, but lots of the population, passive defenses, active defenses. This is a very serious problem. The complacency is not warranted, and it isn't warmongering to point it out. It is necessary, I believe, to our survival. Now, having said all that, Arthur, let's turn quickly to your specific recommendations as to what the United States needs to do. You might want to talk about, among other things, your Quantum Alliance Initiative as an example of the sorts of things need to be done. But give us a flavor of a real roadmap that the Commander-in-Chief of the United States should follow here.
Well, industrial policy tends to be something that, if you look at other countries that have adopted what they call industrial policy, which is really, you know, measures in which the government puts its thumb or even its entire arm on the scale to promote certain kinds of economic activities at home in order to, you know, to overcome disadvantages with rivals, you know, for exporting goods and limiting imports of foreign goods, et cetera, promoting certain kinds of industries, which you look at the kinds of industrial policies that other countries have implemented and have been argued and advocated for in this country from time to time, like in the 1980s when everyone was so terrified of Japan Inc. and the economic competition from Japan and thought, oh, the government's got to get more involved and promote more growth in the U.S. economy and so on. Most of those industrial policies, however, have been devised by economists. So that means that they're bound to fail, right? And this is industrial policy now is something which is really, to paraphrase Clemenceau, is too important to be left to the economists. It now has to be really devised and developed by national strategists, and it has to be part of a national strategy that takes into account the defense industrial base, but also those advanced technologies that are really going to define the future for the 21st century. as well as for our military forces and for the global military balance of power. I'm talking about artificial intelligence. I'm talking about 5G wireless technology, which has become a classic example of how the U.S. has gotten itself bogged down in being unable to develop either a set of standards or to develop a plan to keep the future of wireless technology out of the hands of the Chinese and the Chinese Communist Party's stalking horse in this, which is the IT giant Huawei. And we failed signaling on this. Huawei is now sweeping the globe with its signing of contracts to develop the most advanced wireless technology that's really going to dominate the 21st century. And the U.S. is basically scolding countries, you don't want to do business with Huawei. But at the same time, we've not come up to put our Allen Act together in that development. Supercomputers, nanotechnology, and then the area that I know best and work on, which is quantum computers and quantum technology. Which really will be a revolution in how information technology functions. That these are areas in which a government needs to be, the United States federal government needs to be more involved in advocating a plan, in allocating resources, in bringing together the companies that really do have expertise and leadership in these technologies and saying, you're going to be working for American national interest now. This is going to be important for you guys to work together and to make sure that the United States is the future leader in all of this, because your future, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Intel, IBM, your future depends on a free and secure United States. And your plans for developing and becoming, you know, global and remaining global businesses will be pointless if China is the one who finally wins the struggle for information dominance in the 21st century. That's got to be made clear to corporate executives. It's got to be made clear to our military and defense leadership that these are the technologies that are really going to define the future of the 21st century, and they need to be focused and need to develop strategies that will help America to prevail in those kinds of areas.
This is such an important point, and I think 5G is really an extraordinarily apt example of the challenge, as you say, Arthur. We are looking at a critical technology. I'm not sure it's fully understood, to be honest with you, especially possible health issues associated with it. But certainly in terms of the use that could be made of it by hostile powers like China is something that is largely ignored. But it adds the utmost urgency to the need to have a real American alternative, a secure, hopefully less costly and much more capable technology on offer, or we are going to find all of our adversaries operating with it, but also our friends as well, the Chinese model, that is. Arthur, we have to take one more pause, and we will be right back straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome to the final installment of a really extraordinary conversation with one of the country's foremost thinkers on and champions of America's competitive edge. He is Arthur Herman, a senior fellow with the Hudson Institute and the director of its Quantum Alliance Initiative. And Arthur, I want you to tell us a little bit more about that. But let's finish up on 5G, because I think this really is such an important case study. And we're not getting it right, even now, though the president, I think, is seized with it, and his administration is talking about the importance of it, and they're trying with somewhat intermittent clarity to address the Huawei piece of the alternative. But what should we be doing on 5G right now, and how do we get there from here?
Well, I think there's two things that need to be done. First of all, that the American companies, the telecom operators, who are going to be working in this space, like Verizon and AT&T, need to be brought together, and it needs to be clear that the future of 5G is going to depend upon a single standard that they will be able to put together and will be able to endorse, and that will become the American standard for 5G in direct competition with and in stark contrast to the Chinese standard for 5G, which is going to be a 5G that will be open in all respects to manipulation by Chinese military and Chinese intelligence services. And Huawei executives can deny that as much as possible, but I've been writing about this for the last year and a half, about the dangers of getting involved with Huawei. They tried to silence my column on Forbes.com as a way in which to suppress the information going out about what Huawei and China are doing in this area. They failed to do that. I think that making people aware of just the of the dangers of working with Huawei, but that America needs to present a serious standard to that. Right now, as we speak, there is, in fact, a request for proposals at the Pentagon for developing an alternate model for 5G that's going to be based on a different kind of allocation of spectrum. This is, we're getting into the technical weeds here, but it's important to realize the degree to which having spectrum allocation, particularly the DoD's spectrum, which is large and vast, and a lot of it could be, in fact, put to commercial use, small portions of it, as a way to develop a different way of thinking about how we allocate spectrum and how we develop 5G. So we're in actually a very good position. We're poised to reverse course on 5G in relation to Chinese competition. We just need some political will. We need some stepping up on the part of both administration and the part of Congress in order to do that. That's number one. The second one is we have to start thinking about how we're going to secure all of our data and networks, including future 5G networks, from attack by a quantum computer. And the quantum computers, and I've written about this extensively, the impact of a future large-scale quantum computer of knocking down and intruding into every single public encryption system that protects our data networks, from your bank account to the power grid to government data and resources, encrypted government data and resources, is very real and very profound. And we created at Hudson the Quantum Alliance Initiative in order to make sure that the U.S. and its allies, who are very active in quantum technology leadership, that they maintain that leadership and that they're able to be in a position to deter China when, I notice I say when, not if, it's able to get a quantum computer that could do this catastrophic damage to the protections that we rely on for all of our data and networks, both in government and in the private sector. You talk about a weapon of mass destruction, a large-scale quantum computer. And now the CEO of Google, who are in the business of making quantum computers, has just said that he believes that that we're looking at the end of encryption in about 5 years' time. So the limit that we have, the time limit that we have in order to devise and to build safeguards against that quantum computer attack, that timeline is steadily shrinking. And the urgency for a national industrial policy that aims at winning that quantum race and securing the quantum future is just as important, maybe even more so, really, than securing our defense industrial base, maintaining leadership with artificial intelligence and in supercomputers and nanotechnology. Quantum is going to be king, Frank. Quantum is going to rule all of these technologies. If we lose that, we really lost it.
Arthur, let me just pick up on a point you just made. Google, the last time I checked, was actually helping the Chinese in a variety of ways, and I think, among others, probably in the quantum space. But there's a perfect example of an American company that is playing for the other team. I want to just add that it seems to me that in addition to the problem in corporate boardrooms who have thrown in with the Chinese, we have the problem of Wall Street, which has decided to do the same by investing our money institutional investors, pension funds, individual investors' money through active investments as well as passive indexes in Chinese companies that are engaged in some of the very things that you're talking about that are so alarmingly ominous and dangerous to us. And I just would ask you, could we invest instead in good companies and good projects and good infrastructure investments and the like, and actually wind up having Wall Street enable, you know, the kind of competitiveness and the kind of innovation that this country desperately needs? Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that that having the reshoring of American capital, let's call it that, where Wall Street and our leading financial firms began investing here at home and began investing in the very technologies that we lead in, Frank, in terms of our technical expertise and in terms of commercialization possibilities, they're there. And to disentangle and decouple our nation's financial institutions, including, I'm afraid, the U.S. Treasury, from China, will be another important part of how we go about creating a strong national economy for the 21st century, and one in which, again, this is another pillar of a new industrial policy, is to promote that investment here, investment in the United States, and in the technologies that are really going to make the difference in the 21st century. And, you know, but it's tough. It's tough. We had for 8 years an administration, a Democratic administration, which spent no time working on these issues. In fact, just the opposite, which was, as we've seen from, look at the close relationship between the vice president's son, Hunter Biden, and China, as in lobbying, and you come to understand why the U.S. government and why the administration was so complacent about the China challenge and about how to really, U.S. needed to confront that.
The subject of an important new book by Peter Schweitzer, with whom we were going to speak, I hope, shortly. Arthur Herman, this is such an important point, and I hate to say we're hard out of time, but just to wrap it up, you have made a very compelling case, it seems to me, that there are critical technologies and industrial capacities and trained workforce requirements that we ignore at our extreme peril. And there may be differences as to how you can best meet those requirements, satisfy those needs. But what is unmistakable is if we don't start having, once again, a national security mindedness operating both at the highest levels of the U.S. government, where I think under the Trump administration that is the case by and large, and in corporate boardrooms, whether it's the tech industry or whether it's the other manufacturing capabilities that we have left, or as important as any, Wall Street boardrooms, we are not going to be able to survive against a communist regime like the Chinese that is determined to, well, supplant us is the genteel way of putting it. I think destroy us is actually more likely. But Arthur Herman, your work at the Hudson Institute on quantum alliance issues and on the industrial base requirements and in so much more is really a national treasure. And I appreciate you sharing it with us from time to time. And I do hope we will be in frequent communication in this very, very vital year. Thank you for your time today. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.